Dark Utopia Productions presents Dark Utopia by James G. West. Chapter 1. In the Not Too Distant Future. The foundation of Mark's conscience cracked and crumbled as he fell to his knees, whispering into the phone, "It's over." At the realization the cards had been dealt, the outcome realized, his mind cleared, focusing on a basic, simple goal: survival. He said, "To think I could run from what's happening in Washington, hide in a bankrupt society, and hope it won't affect me. Never again. Goodbye, Amy." He threw the phone on the floor and smashed it with the heel of his shoe. Mark went to his shed, unlocked the door, and grabbed a shovel. He walked to the garden in his backyard. Vegetable plants covered a 4-by-13-foot plot. The soil was contained by raised railroad ties. He moved toward the southeast corner, ripped out the bell and habanero pepper plants. He jabbed the shovel into the topsoil and began to dig. Heaps of grainy black fertilizer poured and flew off the steel blade before it thudded into earthy brown clay. Kicking the blade down, he felt his pores open up as a layer of perspiration formed on his forehead. Wiping his brow, he grunted and continued to dig. He felt his lower back strain as it twisted and tightened. He continued to dig. A stiff vibration roiled through his wrists. He knelt down and brushed the dirt away, revealing the top of a wide PVC pipe. He stood up and dug around the lid. Kneeling back down, he ran his index finger around the top. Feeling the bottom edge of the lid, he grabbed it with both hands and began to turn it counterclockwise. After a few turns, it came free. Staring into the container, he muttered, "Didn't think I would need these again." Nestled against the side leaned a Colt, AR-15 and a 12-gauge Mossberg pump action, 500 Persuader with a 14-inch barrel and pistol grip. At the bottom of the pipe was a box of shotgun shells, 3 loaded 30-round magazines for the AR, and a Sig Sauer P226 9mm pistol. The pistol, cupped into a shoulder holster, had a full magazine with 20 rounds. Another 2 were held in a double magazine pouch with snap-on lids. Mark lifted the AR-15, then grabbed a magazine. He inserted it into the AR, slapped the bottom, pulled back the breech bolt, and lifted the rifle sling over his head. Reaching down, Mark grabbed the shoulder holster and flung it over his left shoulder. A faint smile crept across his face as he reached down, removed the persuader from the pipe, and placed it on the ground. He picked up a box of shells from the bottom. The lid read, 12-gauge high-performance saboted slugs. He proceeded to load 6 shells in the persuader. Mark stood up, walked onto his deck, and slid the glass door open. Turning around to close the door, he paused and gazed at the amber sky raise off the water into a golden yellow. His shoulders dropped and edged forward as a hollow feeling in the pit of his stomach told him this would be his last sunset on the Chesapeake. Chapter 2. 3 days earlier, a summer wind carried the faint smell of sea salt from the Chesapeake Bay as a cloud, like finger paint thumbed into a clear blue sky, breezed westward, its shadow engulfing 2 rusted gasoline pumps that rested in front of a red brick, single-story service station. Adorning the exterior, porcelain oil and gas signs blemished with dull red patina blended into the burgundy blocks of clay. Above, a white aluminum sign read, "Mark's Classic Car Restoration," in chalky black letters. Inside were 3 muscle cars and a 1932 Ford coupe, its polished chrome bumpers peeked out from underneath the ends of a dusty car cover spotted with flakes of paint. Mark Slade stood in blue overalls underneath a 1968 Pontiac GTO that rested on a 2-post lift. A high-pitched whine, followed by thuds and clicks, emitted from his air impact wrench as the interior walls of the socket punched and tightened the last bolt of a Magnaflow exhaust system. He stepped back and stared at the shiny stainless steel that stretched from manifold to muffler. The sound of a woman's voice was heard over the clanking of metal tools and shallow thumping of a rubber mallet hitting the inside of a quarter panel. Mark sighed as he dropped his arms and listened to the news.
"This is Marcia Coakley, speaking to you from the deck of the USS Ronald Reagan steaming toward the South China Sea. We are a part of a carrier strike group consisting of multiple cruisers, destroyers, and submarines on its way to join warships from the U.S. and its allies that have been flooding the international waters around Taiwan. A high-stakes game of chicken is being played out in response to the mobilization of a large-scale Chinese amphibious naval operation. The President of China has issued a warning stating, "Each country must have a right to choose its own path of development without the unwarranted interference of other countries. Strong Chinese-Russian relations are in the interest not only of our nation, but all countries who seek an international balance of peace and respect for the national sovereignty. The United States is interfering with a domestic Chinese situation, and we will not be deterred in any way from completing our goal of Chinese unification under the agreed-upon One China policy. If the United States continues to interfere, China and its allies will retaliate using any and all means available. The United States is playing with fire and needs to understand the dire consequences of such actions." Any and all means would ostensibly consist of two categories, military and economic. The primary military concern is the Chinese hypersonic anti-ship ballistic missiles, or ASBMs, which pose a lethal threat to aircraft carriers because of their ability to penetrate missile defense systems and have garnered the moniker carrier killers. An ASBM begins its flight following the trajectory of a typical ballistic missile. The crucial difference is in the final stage. Hypersonic warheads are fitted with a glide vehicle and are able to perform extreme maneuvers as it glides through the stratosphere, reaching speeds in excess of 6 times the speed of sound. China sees hypersonic weapons as an assassin's mace, a folklore term for a weapon that gives an advantage against a better armed foe. The second category, although less initially dramatic, may have exceedingly dire consequences. The Global Times, a daily tabloid newspaper under the auspices of the Chinese Communist Party, has repeatedly cited experts as saying, "But of course, China might sell all of its U.S. Treasury bonds in an extreme case, like a military conflict." For a better understanding of the financial implications of such a move, we go to economist Robert Coleman, who is the White House member of the President's Commission charged with formulating a U.S. response to China's recent aggressive moves. Mr. Coleman is traveling aboard the carrier on a fact-finding mission.
Thank you, Marcia. Normally, this threat would be dismissed because China holds a small percentage of all U.S. treasuries, and the Federal Reserve would easily be able to purchase these securities and stabilize interest rates. Unfortunately, these are not normal times. America has been experiencing persistent inflation along with a decrease in the value of the dollar, which has led some countries to express concern about holding U.S. bonds that are paid back in dollars. Years ago, when other countries realized the U.S. debt had reached unsustainable levels, the Federal Reserve began massive debt monetization, or what is colloquially known as money printing, which is when the Fed creates money out of thin air to purchase bonds issued by the Treasury. Essentially taking money from your left pocket to pay your right pocket. The economic worry is the dreaded domino effect, whereby if China dumps their U.S. bonds, the price of bonds declines, and other countries in Asia and Europe that hold U.S. treasuries are adversely affected. In response, these other countries, worried the price will decline further, would sell their bonds, causing an additional decrease in price, thereby triggering a domino effect that could result in a spike in interest rates and have potentially disastrous effects on the U.S. economy and inflation. Some economists have expressed fear that the Federal Reserve has backed itself into an inflation trap. If they allow interest rates to rise, the payments on our debt obligation may effectively bankrupt the economy and cause a stock market crash. On the other hand, if they attempt to fight the rise in interest rates and purchase the foreign-owned U.S. securities, the inflation rate could spiral out of control. Marcia.
Thank you, Mr. Coleman, for that summary of the economic issues and potential financial implications of such a scenario. The American president has expressed that although such a maneuver may have negative economic consequences for the U.S., China would experience more severe repercussions as America is the largest market for Chinese exports. There are reports that the premier of China has been speaking with the president of Russia, adding to the concern that there may be a coordinated economic and military response if the Taiwanese crisis escalates. This is Marcia Coakley, reporting to you from the USS Ronald Reagan.
Mark rolled his eyes, thinking, why worry? I'm sure we have our best and brightest working on it, then yelled, enough politics! Would somebody please change the station? A worker switched the streaming channel. A baritone voice tightened and jumped, carried by rhythmic pops of a saxophone. Mark muttered, that's better. He looked down at his phone to check the time. In bright green numbers, it displayed 4:10. Oh, crap, I gotta get going. Mark kicked off his shoes, unzipped the front of his coveralls, and lifted his elbows while shifting his shoulders. The loosely fit dungarees piled at his feet. He stepped out, put on a pair of brown leather sandals, and placed his wallet in the front flap pocket of his shorts. An employee kneeling next to a 1970 Chevelle pointed his Bondo spreader. You got a hot date? Mark grinned at the auto body technician. Yeah, Rick, with your sister. Rick nodded, rubbed his goatee, and said in a raspy voice while soft-hitting his syllables as not to disturb the dip of chew tucked in his lower lip. You make sure and order her 2 dozen hot wings. Drop it in a deep fryer, she'll eat it. No, idiot. I'm going to the doctor. Run out of medication for your syphilis? Mark raised his left hand above his head and displayed his middle finger as he walked outside. Stepping onto a green mountain bike, he shifted his weight onto the left, then right pedal. Sitting back, he coasted and took in the features of a cornfield resting underneath the horizon. His gaze rolled across the way to an old-style ice cream parlor with a soda jerk bar that buttressed a shed-like structure. Beer logos slapped on its exterior surrounded a window with a faint neon sign. Open. After pedaling a half mile, he approached a beige 1940s converted cottage with 2 small pitched roofs peeked out over the first floor. He turned into a sun-baked gravel parking lot and read the shingle that dangled from a wood frame, Dr. Brown, M.D. Whipping his right leg over the seat, he balanced himself on the left pedal and jumped off, kicking up fine white powder that settled on his open-toed sandals. Mark leaned his bike against grooved nylon siding that covered the exterior wall of the closed-in porch. A few feet away, a 7-year-old girl wearing a dark blue dress peppered with little pink crabs rested on a weathered wooden bench. She leaned back on the palms of her hands and gazed up at Mark. Mark looked around, then at the girl. You make sure none of these hooligans take my bike?
There are no hooligans.
He rubbed his chin and squinted his eyes, rolling them left and right. They're all hooligans. The girl giggled and nodded.
Okay.
Whew, thank God, Mark said, wiping his brow. Sitting up straight with suddenly serious demeanor, she asked,
Do you have any kids?
Can't afford them, he said, opening the front door. The girl tilted her head, pursed her lips, and blurted out,
Hey, you can't buy kids, silly.
Shaking his head, Mark's mouth quirked up into a tight smile as he entered the doctor's office and approached a woman wearing loose-fitting scrubs sitting at the reception desk. Hello, Mr. Slade. Please sign in. Mark picked up the pen from the desk, signed in, then held it up by a plastic spork taped to the end, asking, This really keep people from taking your pens? It's still there, isn't it? He nodded and sat down on a worn yellow cushion tied to the spindled backrest of an off-colored wooden dining chair. Leaning forward, he perused the out-of-date magazine strewn across the coffee table in front of him. Small white slivers of paper in the upper left-hand corner read, Robert Brown. The address underneath was blackened out with a magic marker. Mumbling to himself, he pushed the magazines around. Let me see. Journalistic horse shit. People. U.S. Newsweek. Hearing a child's high-pitched laugh, Mark looked up at a 5-year-old boy eavesdropping from the opposite side of the waiting room. The boy's mother gave her son a disciplined elbow nudge as she threw Mark an unapproving look. I'm so sorry about the language, he commented in sing-song tone. Noticing a phone in the boy's hand, Mark said, I'm sure he's used to much more. Erudite vernacular. Her eyes narrowed as she looked over the auto body mechanic from his dust-covered sandals and paint-stained hands to his shaggy, unkempt shoulder-length blonde hair. Looking back down, Mark commented, Ah, grabbing a 6-month-old sailing magazine. He leaned back and flipped through the pages, admiring the expensive boats and yachts with the signature bikini-clad blonde lounging on the bow. After 10 minutes, a thin lady with sunken cheeks opened the office door. shifted her posture, and rested the edge of an oversized laptop on her hip while murmuring, "Mark Slade," in a tired tone. "That's me." Mark followed the nurse. She stopped next to a physician scale. "Still 6'1", 185 pounds," he remarked. She nodded and led him into the private exam room. He sat on the front edge of the examination table, resting his feet on the extended step. She took his blood pressure. 123/75, that's pretty good, Mr. Slade." She opened his file and began to type on the laptop. She adjusted half-moon reading glasses, resting on the tip of her nose. "My God! 178/115. That is quite an improvement." Mark frowned. "Yeah, life minus hard alcohol, Washington politicians and lawyers, equals low blood pressure." She looked up and said, smiling, "Oh, I can't wait to retire to Palm Bay, Florida." Mark watched 10 years vanish as her cheeks lifted and filled. "What about Doc Brown?" "When's he going to retire?" Mark asked. The seasoned healthcare worker shook her head. "Never. He says he loves his job. Me? I'm ready to get out of here and relax in the Florida sun." She picked up her laptop and said, "The doc will be a few minutes," as she left the room and shut the door. After finishing an accelerated bachelor's program at the age of 20, Mark had spent 6 years in the Navy before returning to school, where he earned a law degree and master's in economics. After just a few years working for a prestigious law firm in D.C., it was obvious the atmosphere and politics in Washington didn't agree with his personality and beliefs. The arrogant pretentiousness ruffled his Midwestern humility. The elites at the law firm told him he was highly intelligent and belonged in their company, but Mark knew they secretly looked down on him as provincial because his pedigree did not include an Ivy League sheepskin. It was rumored his wife's father, the Secretary of Homeland Security, had pulled some strings to get him hired, even though that was not true. They even had a secret nickname for him, the Cultured Redneck. Oddly enough, it did not bother him. Meanwhile, his soon-to-be ex-wife, Amy, had no problem with Washington. In fact, she was a product of it and very comfortable in it. The high-powered lunches and chi-chi dinners with politicians and wealthy attorneys fed her personality and fueled her insatiable ego. At social events, Amy bounced like a pinball from click to click, spending the most time with those she would later spread malicious rumors and gossip about. As Mark watched, he could not help but think, what is Washington? A city full of powerful people. What do they produce? Laws, rules, and regulations. People given immense power not because of what they produce, but for what they say. What kind of person does this result in? A narcissistic one. What do these narcissists require? Adulation and a rarefied lifestyle, isolating them from reality. That explains the army of sycophantic interns and recent law graduates swarming Washington like bees to honey, a perpetual hive of pretentiousness and arrogance, maintaining the unfortunate dynamic that holds D.C. back from attaining the maturity of reality. Yep, that was Washington. And that was definitely Amy. Whenever he spoke about Amy, he always got approving nods, accompanied by, "Wow, very impressive," or, "You are a lucky man." Over time, Mark began to feel isolated. He turned to alcohol to numb his unhappiness, but this only resulted in more pain and isolation. Mark's routine before parties had started to include an increasing number of highballs, undocking his inhibitions and presenting two options at social events: to be honest and insolent, or silent and antisocial. He chose the latter. Eventually, he left Washington and separated from his wife in what ended up being a somewhat amicable divorce. Afterwards, he bought a small cottage on the bay in Chesapeake Beach, a small town located in southern Maryland. He took a gamble and used his savings to open a shop for fixing up old classic cars, something he had always dreamed of doing. His love for it began in high school when he worked at an auto body shop and continued through college when it helped pay for tuition. Working on tangible projects with his hands appealed to him. In contrast, when he was a lawyer in Washington, all he did was put pen to paper producing legal briefs with the productive capacity of propping up an uneven table leg. It was not uncommon for Mark to spend a year or more on a team lobbying Congress – for laws that would be mothballed indefinitely. He had been often silently relieved since he knew that lobbies habitually caused economic inefficiency when they successfully shifted the allocation of government expenditures in their favor. He had come to realize during his time in D.C. that the cynics were right and the corrupt influencers with money, rather than the constituents, held power over the politicians. The door opened and Dr. Brown walked in smiling. He had a rectangular face with a defined, sturdy jawline and short-cropped gray hair.
Hey, Mark, how have you been? Catch any good rockfish lately?
Mark spent most of his free time during the summer fishing from his kayak, but also had a 14-foot Boston whaler he used when the weather turned cold or when friends were over. Mark nodded. Yeah, a 15-pounder tried to pull me to the eastern shore last weekend.
Where do you put the fish when you're on the kayak?
Doc Brown asked. Mark smiled. Bend over. I'll show you.
Smartass,
Doc Brown said, laughing. Dr. Brown, a close friend of his father's, had known Mark since he was a boy. Having fond childhood memories of family vacations visiting Chesapeake Beach, fishing, crabbing, and water skiing, Mark decided it would be the perfect place to get away from the politics of Washington and start his business. The doctor wrote a few lines in Mark's file, then put it on the counter and spun around on a black leather stool facing him.
You hear about that insanity over in Taiwan? Those hypersonic missiles are a real problem.
Mark nodded. Well, like Mike Tyson said, everyone has a plan until they get punched in the mouth. Contrary to popular opinion, who wins a war is not necessarily who is more powerful, but rather who is more determined in what they are willing to sacrifice. Look at what happened in Vietnam. We lost 50,000 and over 1 million North Vietnamese died. If you look at the numbers, we should have won. Doc said,
years ago, I would have said they don't have the military to pull off an invasion and would have shrugged off any threat to the dollar. But given the situation in Eastern Europe and the,
Doc made finger quotes,
unexpected, persistent inflation, I have to say I'm worried.
Doc Brown leaned back, took a deep breath, and crossed his arms.
You know the Chinese have a global digital currency. They have the ability to track and even control consumer spending, using their social credit score to dole out rewards or punishments.
Mark nodded. I hear the Fed is planning something similar here.
Can you imagine having no privacy? The government knowing how you spend every penny and the ability to punish you based on political views? If Stalin was alive, he would be salivating at the idea. Human life means nothing to those commies. Their Chinese god, Mao Zedong, starved and killed over 20 million through collectivism. He didn't give a damn about the economic and human cost of his excessive approach towards egalitarianism.
Mark rubbed his index fingers, smiling. Naughty, naughty. You better watch it. You're spreading misinformation. I hope you don't share this on the internet. You could be canceled and labeled an extremist. Mark pointed at Doc, snickering. And lose all your followers. Doc waved his hand.
Yeah, yeah. You understand what is happening better than I do. Your appearance may fool other people, but I know you.
One pivotal difference is the Chinese communists don't allow their people to keep and bear arms. Doc nodded.
You hear the rumors about a national firearms registration bill?
Yeah.
You know, I buried a lot of my guns in airtight tubes.
Mark interrupted. Hey, remember when you buried that gun on public land and they paved a bike path over it? Doc tried to suppress his laughter and leaned forward, wagging his index finger.
That was a cheap, low-caliber rifle. You never bury good guns on public land.
Doc's face grew serious as he continued.
Have you stocked up on canned and dried goods, not to mention that lovely yellow metal? That's my hedge, physical gold, and my go-boat.
Don't you mean go-bag?
A go-bag isn't going to cut it, not if the shit really hits the fan. It's not just China that has me worried, it's the snowball effect. All the trillions held by foreign countries.
Yeah, they mentioned that on the news. I'm trying not to think about it. Not that long ago, mentioning hyperinflation would brand you as a conspiracy nut. Man, have times changed? Mark shrugged his shoulders. Maybe this will be like the Cold War. Everyone worried about nuclear holocaust, people building bomb shelters and stockpiling food. Then nothing.
At least in a nuclear war, it's over quickly. This way, you're filleted alive with the dull knife of authoritarianism and socialism, watching everything you believe in, the entire American way of life, die right in front of your eyes.
I know, Mark said, putting his hands up. I saw all this when I was in Washington, but what can I do about politics? I'm just a simple businessman. That's why I left D.C. Let someone else deal with that crap. I just want to join the rest of the society and concentrate on simple, day-to-day activities like fixing up cars and fishing. He handed Doc Brown his phone. Are you trying to get my blood pressure up? I've downloaded the systolic and diastolic for the last month. Doc took the phone, plugged it into his laptop, and said,
I've known you since you were a boy. That was a good move for you.
A chart appeared on the laptop display.
Are you taking the medication I prescribed?
Mark nodded. Yeah, once a day at breakfast.
Alcohol?
A few beers on the weekends. No hard stuff.
And Old Bay?
Come on. How am I supposed to eat crabs without seasoning?
It's salt. Doc pointed to the laptop and said, Here on Saturday, you had crabs and beer, didn't you?
Give me a break. I'm not going to stop eating crabs.
Just use less Old Bay and stop putting it on your potato chips.
Mark smirked. Okay. I'll stop putting it on my potato chips.
You should stop eating potato chips altogether.
Mark replied, If it tastes good, I'll spit it out. All right. Doc Brown put the tips of his stethoscope in his ears.
Take your shirt off and turn around.
Mark obliged.
Deep breath,
Doc said, placing the diaphragm on his back. Looking at a scar on Mark's lower left back, he commented,
That souvenir from the Middle East giving you any trouble?
No trouble, Mark said, putting his shirt back on, except for the fact that it ended my military career. Doc stood up and handed the phone back.
I'm glad to see you are doing well. What we talked about before, if anything happens, you contact me.
Doc paused and put his hand on Mark's shoulder.
Got that?
Mark looked Doc directly in the eyes and said, I will. I promise. I'll call. Doc opened the door and motioned for Mark to leave.
Tell your old man I said hello.
Mark nodded.
And get a haircut.
Back at the restoration shop, the employees had gone home for the day. Mark turned off the lights and locked the front door. Before he could yell for her, Sadie, his golden retriever, came running from the cornfield behind the shop. How in the hell does she always know? The 4-year-old golden retriever ran to Mark. He grabbed her collar, hooked her leash to the bike, and brushed her golden coat of silky fur with his hand. Have you been chasing rabbits again? After biking for a spell on the paved road with Sadie running alongside, he turned left down a narrow road overgrown with weeds except for 2 tire paths. He stopped and unhooked Sadie's leash. Mark gazed at the calmness of the bay as the evening's twilight glistened off the tops of the small swells. He closed his eyes for a moment and coasted, feeling the comfortable warm breeze pour through his cotton t-shirt and thought, This sure beats riding the metro. Shifting his gaze back to the bay, he noticed the sky had turned a misty red. Doc Brown's comments continued to tug at the back of his mind. He told himself to drop it, mumbling, It's politics. Get it out of your head. You are out of that swamp, so stop thinking about it. Shortly after turning onto a paved road, Mark pulled up to the shed in the front yard of his cottage. He waved to his neighbor across the street and put his bike inside. The cottage was ocean blue with white window frames and doors. It was built in 1948 and had been used as summer getaway for Washingtonians who took the train for a weekend of sailing, leisure, martinis, and cigarettes. It was rumored Babe Ruth spent his summers nearby. The train route had since been shut down, and as the summer cottages deteriorated, people renovated them into year-round residences. Mark entered his home, went to the kitchen, and took a hamburger bun and a patty out of the refrigerator. He dumped a bag of plain potato chips into a bowl and gave them a splash of balsamic vinegar and a peppering of Old Bay. After taking everything to the back deck overlooking the bay, he placed the food on a table and ignited the propane grill. Placing the patty on the grill, he stared at the water glistening in the setting sun and thought again about what Doc Brown said. He went inside and got his cell phone. After returning to the deck, he sat down and called his dad in Kansas City. A male voice answered,
Hello?
Hello, Dad. How are you? Mark said.
Fine. How are you doing?
Pretty good. Almost finished the 68 GTO.
Wow, that's going to be a nice car. A real piece of American history.
Hey, Dad, you mind if I ask you a question?
Sure, no problem.
I was talking to Doc Brown today.
What did he tell you? Buy more guns and canned food?
Well, what do you think of all the ballyhoo with China?
Mark, if they dump their U.S. bonds, they will be cutting their own throat. They need us to buy their products. Doing that would hurt them more than us.
That's true, but China has diversified its supply chains and opened up to other countries, reducing its reliance on the United States. What about the dollar?
What about it?
We're paying over $1 trillion in interest payments, not to mention the inflation. I think the Chinese have been waiting patiently for the Fed to back itself into a corner and take advantage of the situation. Our reserve currency is about to get flambéed by the other BRICS countries like Russia, India, and South Africa, not to mention Saudi Arabia, who are taking payments for oil in Chinese yuan. His dad said, you.
There is always some pending crisis to talk about, an escapism from our dull lives of performing the tasks that need to be done for society to function. In the 1970s, it was severe overpopulation, and we would all be starving in 20 years. They made a movie about it, Soylent Green, with Charlton Heston. Then, in the 1980s, there was going to be a nuclear war. Ronald Reagan was building thousands of nuclear missiles, and he was going to start World War III and kill us all. Oh, don't forget Jimmy Carter's immortal words in 1977, that there was only enough oil in the ground to last another 25 years. And now we have plenty of oil and natural gas, but wait, we can't use them because of global warming. Oh, I'm sorry, climate change. I actually remember reading a paper from the 1970s that claimed the Earth was heading for a mini ice age. They even did a documentary with Leonard Nimoy. You remember all that shit? Somebody's always trying to make a buck.
Those were theories, whereas the dollar and the debt are quantitative hard numbers. So the discussion gets knee-jerked into schoolyard prattle that the other countries are just as bad or worse off, but their standard of living is not propped up by having the reserve currency status. Ours is. Our debt has been rolled over into short-term bonds for the last 30 years because it's cheaper money, which means that the high inflation is having a real-time effect on interest payments on our... As Mark continued, he heard his dad sigh into the receiver. A gut tug told him he just veered into an economic wonkiness that invited the listener to paint over realities with a fresh coat of no-fault patriotism. His dad said,
I believe in the American people. When we face tough times, we fight through them and come out stronger. When you left your job at that prestigious law firm, what did I tell you?
You said you were surprised I had lasted that long.
Do you enjoy what you're doing now?
Yes, very much.
Well, then that's all that matters. Sometimes I fear that you will be pulled back into that crap, because you are extremely intelligent and talented when it comes to politics and economics. But if it makes you miserable, is it really worth it?
Well, it is the dismal science.
Hey, how is Sadie?
She's great. We took the dirt road along the water home today.
And right now, you're looking out over the bay, grilling?
Yeah, so?
I wish I had your life. Stop worrying. Enjoy the evening.
Okay, talk to you later. Mark began to move the phone from his ear, then heard his dad say,
Listen, you're not one of those people pushing an agenda for personal prestige and power, telling people how to live and what to say. You act and believe in what is right, based on morals that are rooted in an understanding of reality. That is how I raised you.
Yeah, sure.
One last thing, and this is important. If anything goes wrong, contact Doc Brown. He will help you. He's not just some crazy old man.
You implied this is just another conspiracy theory.
I don't want to believe it, but maybe times have changed.
Bye, Dad. Chapter 3. The U.S. government has a technology called a printing press, or today its electronic equivalent, that allows it to produce as many U.S. dollars as it wishes at no cost. Former Fed Chair Ben Bernanke. Mark stood with his arms crossed, staring at the 1968 Pontiac GTO covered in gray primer. GTO gas, tires, and oil. The GOAT. I can't believe John DeLorean designed the GTO for Pontiac, then went on to build that stainless steel, time-traveling piece of shit. Mark rubbed his chin. How much horsepower did I add scraping my knuckles installing that Magnaflow exhaust? The car didn't have any tags, but Mark knew most of the local cops and was not too worried. His main concern was keeping the car clean, otherwise he would have to wipe her down with a damp chamois and re-sand parts of the body when he got back. Mark threw his hands up. Fuck it. Getting into the car, he turned the key and felt the Nunzi Romano 455 cubic inch 500 horsepower motor come alive. Feeling the vibrations roil through his fingers, he envisioned the pistons slamming compressed gas against spark plugs and being thrust down. The sounds of combustion rumbling through the performance exhaust triggered Mark's primal instinct as he pressed the thin groove pedal lower and lower. The RPM gauge popped and jumped, past 5,000 revolutions. A bearded mechanic stuck his head out from behind the raised hood of a 1970 Plymouth Cuda. He caught eyes with the other employees and nodded toward the GTO. Mark shifted into first and popped the clutch. Whole note high-pitched screeching was followed by smoke pouring off the rear tires as they spun in place, then gained traction, Jack rabbiting the GOAT forward. Mark's head snapped back as he turned left while slapping the shifter into second, causing the rear end to slide right then left. The employees looked at each other and shook their heads, grinning. Mark smiled as the wind and soft rays of late afternoon sun hit his face and thought about his lawyer buddies in D.C. working on senseless litigation. He turned on the aftermarket radio and hit seek. The radio tuned into a financial talk show. Mark noticed a sign on the side of the road next to a truck advertising fresh, hard, and soft shell crabs. Mark thought, I could make a fried soft shell crab sandwich tonight. He had begun to slow down when the radio caught his attention.
As the USS Gerald R. Ford Aircraft Carrier Strike Group entered the Taiwan Strait, China launched multiple supersonic missiles, also known as carrier killers. The strike group's Aegis ballistic missile defense system launched a barrage of glide phase interceptor missiles and used laser defenses and electronic warfare, intercepting all but one of the inbound missiles. The remaining missile slammed into the main hangar bay located midship, its explosion destroying aircraft and damaging the main deck above. The USS Gerald R. Ford was immobilized and crew members scrambled to put out the fires and secure damage to the nuclear reactor. The number of casualties has not yet been reported. The President of the United States is meeting with the Joint Chiefs of Staff and will be giving a televised speech apprising the nation on the crisis. We have been informed that all U.S. naval craft have been ordered to halt their advance toward the Taiwan Strait.
Everyone has a plan, Mark muttered, downshifting as he turned the wheel, popped the clutch, and slammed his foot on the gas, grunting, until they get punched in the mouth. The Detroit muscle roared as its rear tires screeched, sliding across the double yellow line, then gripping the black top and propelling the GTO toward town. Mark leaned forward and turned up the radio. The commentator continued,
Immediately following the attack, the Chinese government began selling their stockpile of U.S. bonds. This move was coordinated with Russia and a number of Middle Eastern countries who have dumped hundreds of billions of additional bonds onto the market in an attempt to knock the American dollar from its reserve currency status. Although a couple trillion in U.S. Treasury securities do not represent a large percentage of overall American debt, perception in the financial markets often becomes reality. This perceived reality has resulted in a decreased demand, thereby causing the value of U.S. treasuries to plummet, resulting in a spike in interest rates. This increase in interest rates appears to be causing the value of U.S. government bonds to collapse and has spread to the corporate bond market, where companies were able to stay afloat by borrowing at very low yields. Hedge funds have reacted by dumping U.S. government debt, and it is being reported that foreign central banks, particularly Japan, have begun to dump their dollar-denominated assets. Investors have rushed to purchase other currencies such as the euro and commodities, especially gold. Since imports make up a substantial portion of overall goods purchased by consumers, measures of inflation based on the price of imports is rapidly increasing. In response, the Federal Reserve has attempted to halt the rise in interest rates by purchasing the Treasury securities, which has only added fuel to the fire, causing further downward pressure in the value of the dollar. After a 14,000-point drop in the Dow, the New York Stock Exchange shut down this morning in a failed attempt to stem the crash in equities prices. The president is convening an emergency session of Congress to determine what steps to take next. There are also reports of ATMs temporarily shutting down or providing a trivial amount of dollars per individual account to be withdrawn.
5 minutes later, Mark approached the town center. Seeing the line stretch out the front doors of his bank, he double-parked, ran towards the entrance, and stood behind an elderly, white-haired lady. Mark watched her hand tremble as she fished through her purse.
"I'm going to get out all my savings, all $50,000,
she said, her voice cutting sharp in a scratchy tone.
"And I'm going to buy gold."
The man in front of her turned around and said, "First of all, I don't think the bank has $50,000 for you, and second, gold has shot up to over $6,000 an ounce. So you might be able to buy 8 ounces if the bank gave you $50,000, which they won't." The old lady shook her head.
"What do you mean? This is a bank. I gave them my money. They better have it."
The man turned forward, shaking his head. "The best you could hope for is maybe 10 cents on the dollar, so $5,000.
"What about the rest of my money?"
the old lady asked. Mark responded, "It's called fractional reserve banking, whereby only a fraction of the bank deposits are backed by cash. This is done to theoretically expand the economy by freeing capital for lending." The seasoned citizen gasped.
"A Ponzi scheme?"
Mark tilted his head. "No, not really. It has characteristics of a Ponzi scheme, but is intended to grow the economy with the assumption everybody doesn't ask for their money back at the same time. That's how a bank makes its profit, by lending your money to other customers willing to pay interest on a loan." The man interrupted. "Ma'am, the value of the dollar is plummeting. My advice is to go and buy as many canned goods as possible. You know, stuff that doesn't spoil." Mark said, "What our government has done with the debt, that is the real Ponzi scheme. They sold bonds to the Federal Reserve, who then printed the money, or the digital equivalent to pay the Treasury, so the politicians would have money to spend. Because of the continuing excessive increases in spending, the U.S. government did not earn enough to repay maturing bonds it had previously sold. It therefore issued more bonds to repay the bonds it previously sold. What the government did was pay off old debt by issuing new debt." The old lady's brow furrowed.
"Huh?"
Mark responded, "Let's say there is a group of villages where each village produces, buys, and trades goods. Everyone agrees to use dollars that you print in your village."
"Yeah."
"One year your village makes less goods and sells less goods. As a result, you have less money to spend, but the people in your village want to consume the same amount. Well, you just print the money and buy goods produced by the other villages. There doesn't seem to be any consequences, so you come to the conclusion, why not just print more money and import more goods? This goes on for years, and then one day there is too much money chasing too few goods."
"The other villages would get upset,"
the lady said. Mark nodded. "Ah, exactly. And the other villages, watching you print money, begin losing faith in the stability of the dollars. They get together and start getting rid of, or dump their dollars in exchange for commodities like gold or other currencies. As the selling continues, it reaches a tipping point or an unforeseen event that triggers an acceleration, causing the value of the dollar to crash. Then one day, you wake up and find no one wants your money. It is therefore worthless. And you can print all you want, but there is no one who will take it. It's like watching a stock go to zero with no underlying fundamental value.
Is that what's happening?
That was how the politicians were able to offer social programs. The U.S. had the printing press. The dollar is only valuable by government fiat, meaning there is nothing supporting it but the full faith and backing of the U.S. government. The dollar was the world's reserve currency, which is why the rest of the world has put up with us printing away our debt. Ma'am, what you are witnessing is the unraveling of the largest Ponzi scheme in the history of mankind. The man shook his head. That's impossible. The U.S. dollar is too important, and the world depends on our economy to consume their goods. At some point, the debt matters. This is that point, Mark retorted. The man glanced at Mark's paint-stained overalls and smirked, clearly thinking, what does this grease monkey think he knows about finance? Noticing the look on the man's face, Mark gave his best Gomer Pyle impression. Well, golly, that's what the guy on the picture box said. You mean a television set? The man asked. Mark's body knocked forward. What are you? One of them college boys. Think you're better than the rest of us. The man began laughing. So, what are you going to do? I'm going to buy as many supplies as I can, like you said. At least I'll have fresh vegetables from my garden for a few more months. After waiting over 20 minutes, Mark was second in line. He watched the financial news on the flat screen above the cashier and read the closed captioning at the bottom as the anchor spoke.
The Chinese government issued a press release stating China has accumulated the largest gold reserve of any other country, including the United States. This has been corroborated with documentation and testimony from independent sources. This announcement has brought into question the validity of the U.S. claim to be the largest holder of gold reserves. Rumors in the financial community are that the Chinese may attempt to back their digital currency with gold. We have just received a press release from Xinhua, the official press agency of the People's Republic of China. It appears to be a statement or a type of ultimatum previously expressed by China. The U.S. government has gone to all lengths to appear before the world as the one that claims the moral high ground, yet has covertly done things that are as audacious as torturing prisoners of war, slaying civilians in drone attacks, and spying on world leaders. Under what is known as the Pax Americana, we fail to see a world where the United States is helping to diffuse violence and conflicts, reduce poor and displaced populations, and bring about real, lasting peace. Moreover, instead of honoring its duties as a responsible leading power, a self-serving Washington has abused its superpower status and introduced even more chaos into the world by interfering with one of the greatest trends in history, Chinese reunification between the two sides of the Taiwan Strait. Let our Taiwanese compatriots be fully assured of their property, religious beliefs, and legitimate rights and interests. The days when the destinies of others are in the hands of a hypocritical nation must be terminated. A new world order must be put in place, according to which all nations, big or small, poor or rich, will have their key interests respected and protected on an equal footing. To begin with, all nations must hew to the basic principles of international law, including respect for sovereignty and keeping hands off domestic affairs of others. What may also be included as a key part of an effective reform is the introduction of a new international reserve currency to replace the U.S. dollar so that the international community may permanently stay away from the spillover of the intensifying domestic fiscal, monetary, and social turmoil in the United States.
Mark facepalmed and shook his head, muttering, "Communist boilerplate."
"Hello, sir. How can I help you?"
a woman behind the counter asked. Mark said, "I would like to empty out my checking account," while handing her his identification.
"Yes, sir. We are currently able to give 8 cents on the dollar."
8 cents? Mark barked. The teller straightened her posture as her tone strained into the high-pitched pluck of an out-of-tune violin.
"Sir, we are a member of FDIC, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, so your money is guaranteed by the federal government up to $250,000.
"Are you serious? The federal government?" Mark frowned. "So, I just wait for the Fed to print more money, then it will get deposited into my account. That's the problem, don't you get it? Mark waved his hand dismissively and said, Just give me the money. Mark left the bank and drove to the local market that sat at the edge of a cornfield, the exterior walls covered in a rustic wood paneling, giving it a small town, country feel. He slowly followed a line of parked cars, pickup trucks, and SUVs. Chassis tilted, wheel wells lifted above tires planted in the cornfield opposite the pair on the blacktop. Parking behind a white F-150 Ford pickup, he instinctively leaned forward to read a bumper sticker on the tailgate displaying a picture of John Wayne wearing a cowboy hat with the caption, Life is tough, but it's tougher when you're stupid. No shit, Mark thought as he pushed the door open into a row of cornstalks and began negotiating his way through the field of tall, cross-pollinated plants to arrive at the back of the country store. Mark entered the supermarket and stood in amazement as he stared at the empty shelves. An elderly lady in her late 50s, wearing a vintage straw hat and rhinestone-studded glasses, picked up the last potato in the produce section. A few feet away, a young, darkly tanned woman wearing a Jack Daniels tank top jutted forward and grabbed the potato. The older woman grimaced and tightened her grip, yelling, No, this is mine! The young surly lady balled up her fist while thrusting it forward, hitting the old woman in the gut. The old lady doubled over as the potato rolled out of her palm onto the floor. The thin thug stood up, potato in hand, eyes widened to the unexpected grip of elderly hands clasped around her neck. A large, thick-chested man in a black leather vest approached and grabbed the older woman by the hair, jerking her head back. Mark moved to help but stopped when he saw a tall, wiry farmer in denim overalls pick up a 3-gallon pickle jar from the deli counter. Holy shit, Mark said, as he watched the farmer bring the jar down on the ruffian's head. The glass shattered, releasing a gush of pickle juice that poured down the biker's handlebar mustache, covering the bully in vinegary dill water before he fell to the ground, unconscious. A heavy-set policeman in his mid-40s stood 10 feet away, ignoring the entire incident while placing bottles of taco sauce into his cart. Mark quickly made his way to the canned goods aisle. Post-it notes were underneath the empty shelves stating, Limit 2 per person. 2 cans of chicken soup lay on their sides at the back of the bottom shelf. He grabbed the cans. In his peripheral vision, he noticed the policeman approaching his right side. Mark turned and asked, Can I help you, officer? Sweat was pouring down the fat man's face, and he was breathing so hard that Mark thought he was going to have a heart attack. In between pants, the policeman asked in an ornery tone,
Do you have any children?
Mark's brow furrowed. No, why? The policeman pulled out his pistol and pointed it at Mark's forehead. Mark stood staring down the barrel of the Glock 22. He felt time slow down as the adrenaline pumped through his bloodstream. Mark watched in slow motion as a drop of sweat ran down the forehead of the man's face to the end of his little pug nose. It dangled off the tip and swayed left and right. The seconds felt like minutes. The cop shook his head. Droplets of sweat leaped from the short black hairs of his 1950s-style flat top. The policeman yelled,
I have 5 kids at home. I need that more than you.
Mark dropped the cans on the floor and stared at the pistol. This may surprise you, but this isn't the first time I've had a gun pointed at my head. As the policeman looked into Mark's eyes, the gun began to wobble.
Just give me the soup.
You are not worth it, coward. You should be helping these people, Mark said as he turned around and walked away. The policeman picked up the cans of soup and placed them on top of the small mountain of groceries in his shopping cart. Mark continued to walk around the supermarket, grabbing whatever he could. Pasta? Yeah, pasta. That won't go bad. He ran to the pasta aisle and saw there was one box of fettuccine left. Grabbing it, he noticed another stranger approaching out of the corner of his eye. Mark turned his head and yelled, Back off! This is mine! The man stopped and began to walk backwards while putting his hands in the air.
Okay, what the hell?
Mark turned and muttered, I could use that. Picking up a jar of tomato sauce that was hidden behind the fettuccine, he continued aisle by aisle, grabbing what he could. The cash register lines ran all the way to the rear of the supermarket. He looked in his wallet and thought, Who knows what these pieces of paper will be worth in a day? Standing at the rear of the line, Mark watched the policeman push his overflowing shopping cart through the crowd of people yelling,
"Move! This is official police business,"
as he moved toward the exit. A fit young man in his mid-20s stepped in front of the cart and demanded,
"Wait in line like the rest of us."
The policeman pulled out his gun and pointed it at the young man. The kid yelled,
"You're going to have to shoot me."
"I'm serious. You either get out of my way or I'll shoot. I have 5 kids at home, and I'll be damned if I'm going to let them starve."
The young man said,
"You think you're the only one with kids? We all have family. Kids, brothers, sisters. What makes yours so special?"
The policeman shook the gun and said,
"I make them special. They are special to me, and they are special to you, because if you don't get out of my way, I will shoot you in your goddamn head."
The policeman pointed the gun up and fired into the ceiling. As the shot rang out, high-pitched screams were followed by customers rushing to the exits with their groceries. Mark found the entrance to the rear storage area and pushed open the swinging doors. He made his way through empty cardboard boxes and plastic crates that lined the walls and kicked the push-bar panic exit device, causing the steel exit door to swing open. He made his way through empty cardboard boxes and plastic crates that lined the walls and kicked the push-bar panic exit device, causing the steel door to swing open. While negotiating his way back through the cornfield, he bumped into a teenage kid and instinctively said, "Excuse me." Ignoring Mark's comment, the kid chopped an ear of corn off a green stalk with a large knife, then threw it into a plastic trash bag hanging from a wire loop attached to his waist. "Hey, what are you doing?" Mark asked. The little corn rustler paused, looked at him, then continued chopping. As Mark approached the GTO, he picked up 2 ears of corn lying on the ground and threw them on the passenger seat. He sat behind the wheel and put the keys in the ignition, paused and whispered, "Jesus Christ," watching dozens of dark figures outlined by the setting sun move forward through the cornfield, leaving row after row of stripped green stalks in their wake. After slowly backing out of the cornfield onto the road, he turned on the radio. A business commentator named Santini was reporting that Japan has continued dumping their U.S.-backed securities along with the Bahamas and the Cayman Islands. Santini said,
"The Federal Reserve's purchase of U.S. debt-backed securities had temporarily halted interest rate rise, but with increased sales by Japan, the United Kingdom, and Brazil, the value of the dollar has continued to plummet."
A second commentator, Niesman, said,
"Everything is going to be all right. The depreciation of the dollar is overstated."
Niesman continued to explain how the market will bounce back, saying,
"Everybody should take a deep breath. Things will be better in the morning. The dollar has not depreciated 50%. It could not happen that quickly. It's impossible."
Santini interrupted,
"This is not normal inflation, which may be attributed to a variety of factors. Hyperinflations throughout history have been triggered by the loss of confidence of foreign holders of a currency. Hyperinflation occurs when a government cannot borrow money because its debt has risen so much that investors believe they will never be paid back with close to the same purchasing power. This is happening right now."
"I don't believe that,"
Niesman said. Santini retorted,
"The people need to know the truth. I will not continue to spread unrealistic commentary on our fiscal and monetary situation. For years, this network has been uncritical of the Federal Reserve and deferred to its chairman's commentary as gospel. This is not the first time. Before the financial crisis of 2008, we reported and supported Chairman Bernanke's statement in 2007 that I quote, 'We believe the effect of the troubles in the subprime sector on the broader housing market will be limited, and we do not expect significant spillovers from the subprime market to the rest of the economy or to the financial system. I am sorry that I have not spoken up before this was a crisis. I believe we have failed as a network and as individual journalists in our responsibility to report honest, unbiased economic and financial news."
Mark turned the radio off and drove back to his shop. It was completely deserted. He went inside and looked at the cash register, which was open and empty. Mark grabbed his house keys, locked the front door, hopped in the goat, and began to drive home. He turned the radio back on, curious to hear what was happening across the country. The radio news anchor was describing the unfolding chaos in cities across America with riots and stores being looted. Mark changed the station. A man being interviewed described his website giving people the ability to barter or trade items. He stated the site name was hometownbarter.com, explaining how tomorrow one would be able to exchange goods with fellow citizens that live near them. He went on to explain how the site would work, expecting the most common form of currency to be gasoline, as it would quickly become scarce, yet remain portable and easy to measure. Mark mumbled to himself, "This would be a really good time to be a farmer. At least you wouldn't starve." Then he remembered his experience in the cornfield. Well, maybe not. The program was interrupted with a high-pitched tone, then a voice saying, "This is an emergency broadcast from the President of the United States." The president's voice came over the radio, explaining that a contingency plan was being implemented. "Good evening. Many Americans are feeling anxiety about their finances and their future. I understand your worry and your frustration. We're in the midst of a serious financial crisis, and the federal government is responding with decisive action. The Federal Communications Commission will use AI to institute a CIN, a Critical Information Needs Program. This program will monitor information and perform a content analysis of how news is presented in broadcast television and radio. An emphasis will be placed on descriptive content and production elements within each broadcast. We will perform analyses on internet content, crawling websites for every category of CIN. We will also perform qualitative analysis of media providers with particular emphasis on ownership characteristics and decision-making. The CIN program is essential to ensure that communication outlets are providing the vital information the public needs in order to navigate these difficult times and protect citizens from disinformation. I have signed an executive order instituting the National Defense Resources Act. The Secretary of Agriculture will have the power to require acceptance and priority of contracts for orders with respect to food resources, resource facilities, livestock resources, and plant health resources. To ensure power companies are able to supply electricity, the Secretary of Energy will also have these powers with respect to all forms of energy. Because people will need health care, the Secretary of Health and Human Services will have full authority with respect to health resources. The Secretary of Defense will control and dispense all water resources. The Secretary of Transportation will make sure all forms of civil transportation will continue running by temporarily taking control of all public and private forms of our transportation infrastructure, and the Secretary of Commerce will oversee all other materials, services, and facilities, including construction materials. The President went on to explain that the government needed to step in and take over these sectors of the economy because hyperinflation was impeding people's ability to use currency toward the purchase of food, electricity, and gas. The implementation of this new system would be organized from a central location, Washington, D.C. Mark felt a cold chill run up his spine. He turned onto his home street and stared at the glassy, calm water, thinking, "I knew this could happen, but didn't want to believe it would." He reached his house, pulled into the driveway, and parked. Mark's neighbor across the street stood on his front lawn with his two young boys holding a pump-action 12-gauge shotgun. Mark walked over. "Hey, Gordon." A lifetime waterman, Mark's neighbor, Gordon, looked the part, standing a solid 6 feet 3 inches tall with a full, scraggly beard.
"Mark, can you fucking believe this? I told you. You should have stocked up on food,"
Gordon exclaimed, shaking his 12-gauge shotgun above his head. Mark cracked a half grin and replied, "I'm not worried. The president is going to take care of us, feed us, clothe us, shelter us." Gordon jerked his arm up and down, cocking the shotgun, and yelled, throwing his voice into the air for any neighbors that might be listening,
"Let them try to enter my house and take my property. I'll shove this 12-gauge straight up their ass."
Mark pushed out a hollow, nervous laugh, waved, and said, "All right." As he turned around, walked back, and entered his house, Sadie came running to him with her tail wagging and put her two front paws on Mark's knees as he knelt to pet her. "Hello, girl. Did you miss me?" Petting Sadie, Mark forgot about the day's events for about 3 seconds. Trying to gain full awareness of what happened, he grew tired and shuffled to his couch, dropped face down, and fell asleep. Chapter 4. Mark woke up to the sound of Sadie barking. She was staring at the front door, her mouth open and tail wagging. The dark living room filled with shifting rays of light slicing through window blinds. A high-pitched screeching sound of industrial brake pads being pressed against truck rotors filled the air, accompanied by the slow grumbling of diesel engines. Mark walked to the blinds, pushed down a couple rows, and peered out the window. Large, beige, mine-resistant, ambush-protected, armored personnel vehicles lined the road. Mark shook his head. MRAPs. He looked back at Sadie, knelt down, and scratched behind her ears, saying, "Calm down, baby." The sound of boots hitting blacktop began off in the distance, and as they got louder, Sadie began barking again. A fist pounded on the front door. Mark slowly exhaled, then stood up and put his hand on the doorknob. Looking down at Sadie, Mark said, rolling his eyes, "It's the National Guard. They have come to help with food, water, and medicine." He opened the front door. "Hello, it's sure good to see you guys. I could use some food and bottled water. I heard the president on the radio." Mark backed up as a brutish man, decked out in full riot gear, stepped into the house.
"Are you Mark Slade?"
Mark nodded. "Yes." The soldier looked down at a PDA, tapped the screen, and pointed, saying,
"Sir, look at this,"
as he showed it to his commanding officer. The CO asked,
"You were a Navy SEAL?"
Mark nodded and said, "Technically, yes, but I wasn't very good at it. To tell you the truth, guns make me nervous." The big man pointed again to the PDA, then looked at the CO.
"Two silver medals and a Purple Heart."
The CO jutted his lower lip out and said,
"And the Navy Cross."
The corners of the tall man's mouth quirked up.
"And guns make you nervous. Do you own any firearms?"
"What?"
"You heard me, hero."
"No, I do not own any firearms."
"The war hero says he doesn't have any firearms. You know we have the right to search your premises."
Mark shook his head. "I don't have any firearms, and even if I did, you need a search warrant." The soldier with the PDA standing next to the CO pulled out a piece of paper and began to read aloud.
"The National Emergency Act, instituted by the President of the United States as of 5 p.m. this evening, gives the government the temporary right to search and seize any property and firearms that it deems a need or threat to the Republic. Under this act, anyone who does not comply with these orders will be detained. The National Emergency Act suspends the right of habeas corpus, or the right of an individual under arrest to be brought before a judge or into a court of law. This right has been..."
The hulky man looked up at Mark, craned his thick neck forward, and barked,
"Suspended by the President of the United States of America as of 5 p.m.
Mark looked down at his watch. It was 11:35 p.m. Calling upon his experience as a lawyer, Mark replied, "The privilege of the writ of habeas corpus shall not be suspended unless, when in cases of rebellion or invasion, the public safety may require it. We are not being invaded, and I'm not rebelling. I'm cooperating. Under the Fourth Amendment, search and seizure, including arrest, should be limited in scope according to specific information supplied to the issuing court, usually by a law enforcement officer who is sworn by it." Mark raised his voice, looking at the soldier holding the document, and said more fiercely, "Which means you need a goddamn warrant." The CO grabbed the document from the soldier, looked at Mark, and said,
"Exigent circumstances, Perry Mason."
Looking down, he read aloud,
"Law enforcement officers may conduct warrantless searches in several types of exigent circumstances where obtaining a warrant is dangerous or impractical."
Mark looked at Sadie and said, "The Stasi is going to implement a warrantless search." The CO slowly glanced around the cottage, then turned to the soldier.
"Toss it."
Four soldiers entered Mark's home and began searching. They threw the cushions off the couch, then flipped it over. A soldier unbuttoned and removed an upside-down knife sheathed below his left shoulder and cut the bottom of the couch and the cushions. Sadie began barking at the CO. The tall man looked down, lifted his M16, and pointed it at her head. Mark ran to Sadie, dropped to his knees, and muzzled her mouth with his hands, then picked her up and carried her out of the room. The soldiers entered the kitchen. The sound of pots and pans banging rang out as they threw the contents of the cupboards on the floor. In the bedroom, they flipped the bed over and pulled all the drawers out of Mark's dressers, dumping his clothes on the floor. In the bathroom, they tossed everything out of the medicine cabinet. Lastly, they entered Mark's office and emptied his desk drawers onto the floor. There was one drawer that was locked. Rather than ask Mark for the key, the soldier took the butt of his M16 and busted the lock off. When they were finished, a soldier walked to the front of the house and reported to the CO,
"The house is clean."
The CO walked up to Mark and asked,
"Do you have food in storage?"
Mark's head cocked back as he threw his hands up. Private property. The soldier with the PDA pulled out a different piece of paper and began reading aloud.
"The National Defense's Resource Act gives authority to the President to promote the national defense over performance of any other orders, and to allocate materials, services, and facilities as deemed necessary to secure national security. This includes, but is not limited to, the allocation of food resources, food resource facilities, livestock, veterinary, and plant health resources, and the seizure and relocation of farm equipment and fertilizer."
Mark rubbed his chin as his eyes rolled up. "The Texas Longhorn should be here by the end of the week. I was told by the foreman they are pushing herd up through Virginia, but the chuck wagon is running low on sugar." Mark tilted his head toward the status thugs, commenting, "Personally, I think one of the boys has a sweet tooth." A thin S-shaped vein bulged above the CO's left temple as he yelled,
"Do you have any food in storage?"
"These are top shelf, lean, delicious cuts. I'll give you the veteran discount," Mark said. Ignoring Mark, the CO looked at the large soldier with the PDA. The soldier tapped the screen numerous times, then stated,
"We don't show any credit card purchases of food rations."
The CO shook his head.
"All right, let's get out of here,"
he said, following the soldiers out of the house, then stopped, turned around, and commented,
"Thank you and have a nice evening, war hero."
Mark just stood there, his mouth agape, staring at the CO walk away, then yelled, "You sure you don't want to put a down payment on some Longhorn T-bones, you fucking asshole?" Closed the door and looked around his house in shambles while letting out a sigh. Sadie bit down on a cushion and dropped it on the couch. "Thanks, buddy," Mark said, hearing yells come from across the street. There was a shotgun blast, followed by automatic machine gun fire. That's Gordon's house. Mark ran across the street, entered Gordon's house, stopped, stood and stared. Behind a flipped-over couch, there were three bodies. As Mark walked closer, he saw Gordon lying in a pool of blood, one arm holding the shotgun and the other wrapped around his two boys, James, 16, and Mike, who had just turned 14 the week before. Both boys were shot in the chest. Looking closer, Mark saw additional bullet holes in their foreheads. Gordon's body was riddled with over 20 bullets. Mark turned around and screamed at the soldiers, "You executed teenagers! You fascist pieces of shit! I'm gonna kick your—" Mark felt someone grab his arm, then a slight pinprick in his neck. Everything turned black.